let's take a minute now and talk about direct mail mailing lists. You're going to need to get some mailing lists when you do direct mail, and here are some resources that are available to you. Probably the biggest mailing list resource in the country is melissadata.com, www.melissadata.com. We also use a company called ListSource, which gave us a list on that last case study. These are list providers. You know, the direct mail business is a multi-billion dollar industry, and they have every list of every person, you know, from every situation you can imagine. So you call these people up, or you go through their lists of lists, and you can get lists of homes by location, by value, by approximate credit rating, all sorts of things. If you Google real estate mailing lists, you can also find all kinds of companies that specifically provide mailing lists to real estate investors. So that's another good resource. You can look for these lists online, or you can actually hire something called a list broker. This is a list broker I use. Her name is Kelly Rocheski. List brokers are simply experts that know how to find the list you're looking for. There's so many lists out there, you can find them yourself, or you can just hire somebody to go find the right list for you, and you call your list broker and you kind of describe, this is a business I'm in, this is the kind of list I'm interested in, and your list broker will go ferret out the right list for you. My experience is that it doesn't necessarily cost anything to use a list broker versus doing it yourself. In other words, the list broker actually gets a commission when you buy the list. The person who's selling the list actually pays a fee to the list broker for finding that list for you. So that's how they get paid. You can also ask your marketing or printing rep or realtor to get you a list. Realtors have access to something called RealList, and they have many different mailing lists available to them for free. I have a local print shop, and my print shop has all sorts of lists that are available to them for free. Sometimes your local title companies have lists for free. A lot of states have title companies that have what are called NOD lists, notice of default lists, and they will give you that list for free. So there's many different sources of paid and free list. Here's another tip. You might want to use an online print shop, or you can use a local print shop. Local print shops will give you a lot more customized service. You know, they'll design your card for you, maybe design a logo for you, and they'll give you quick turnaround and deliver the postcards directly to your house if you want to do your own mailing. Or you can use an online print shop. For example, we've used postcards.com. With postcards.com, all you have to do is upload a picture of your postcard or your art, or you can customize the postcard right on their website. And they will print the postcards. You give them your list. You send them your list. They will print the postcards. They will address them to your list. And they will mail them, put the postage on and mail them to you. So it's totally turnkey done for you. And it's pretty cheap as well. So we really like that as a great resource as well. Okay, let's take a few minutes and talk about some of the specific different lists. And we'll start by talking about the divorce list. You know, there's so many different lists of people you can go after with direct mail, and these are some of the examples. First one is divorce list. You know, we had two people that were paying a mortgage, right? And now one of them left, and there's only one remaining, and the remaining spouse very often can no longer afford to make the payments, so they need a quick solution. And by the way, it's often a quick solution, because a lot of times when somebody has a fight, they move out immediately. You know, you've got an immediate problem. You know, there's nobody to pay the next mortgage. So these people tend to be very motivated to do something very, very quickly. Where do you get the divorce list? Well, you know, divorce laws change and vary by state. Usually the public records have lists of people that have recently filed for divorce. In different states, they have, like, some states you have to actually file an intention to get divorce, and it's kind of like an early warning that you're going to be filing for divorce. It's also an early warning that you may have a house that you need to sell quickly. So if you get these lists, you can basically start marketing to them. You know, we have a kind of an amusing ad we've sometimes done to the divorce list that says, you know, you dumped your spouse, now sell your house, right? You know, it's kind of funny, and it makes the point that a lot of times people that are getting divorced need to sell a house quickly. Now, a couple of tips with regards to the divorce list. Whenever we're dealing with divorcing couples, It's not unusual that we have, you know, fighting divorcing couples. These people just split up. They're probably not very happy with each other. But in most cases, both names are on the deed, and maybe both names are on the loan, so they're both going to have to cooperate when selling the house. And if they're not cooperating, my best tip is this. Figure out which one is more cooperative, the husband or the wife, and then try to get the less cooperative one to deed the house over to the more cooperative one. So basically, if the husband is the problem guy, you basically say, hey, you know, we're going to help sell this house quickly, but I tell you, it's really complicated. You know, your wife lives here and you live there, and we're going back and forth, and there's a lot of communication. Would you mind just signing this warranty deed, deeding your interest over to the house? And there's not going to be any money made on this. This works well for like short sales and mortgage assignments. But it'll allow us to simply get whatever we need signed by the wife and get this thing sold quickly. And very often we can get one or the other party to deed their interest over to the other party so that we can then work the deal with that one person. And it's beneficial for a couple of reasons. It makes it simpler for us. But the most important reason it's beneficial is even if they are cooperative at the beginning of the process, you know, when you're talking about getting it under contract and starting this thing, sometimes 2 weeks or a week or 3 weeks or whatever later when you're actually ready to close or buy or assign the house or whatever, sometimes they're not cooperative at that point. And now you've got fighting spouses and one of them says, I'm not going to sign until she gives me back my golf clubs or until she does whatever. I'm not going to sign until that dirty, rotten bastard does whatever. And that means basically they'll never sign. So it's just safer to have one of them deed the thing over to the other, and then you only have to worry about one person coming to the closing table. Now, one other little comment here. Be aware of only names on the deed sell. The person who owns the house is whoever's name is on the deed, and that's the person who can legally sell the house. Now, the person whose name is on the note is the person who's actually affected if the house gets foreclosed on or assigned or whatever. And it's not always the same person. For example, a guy buys a house. So he gets a loan and he buys a house. Now his name is on the deed and his name is on the note. And then he gets married. And now the wife's name goes on the deed. They both own the house, but the husband's name is the only name on the note. And then they get divorced. Now we've got something interesting. Now the wife's name, you know, she gets the house deeded over to her, so her name is on the deed, but the husband's name is still on the note. The truth is, you know, it's his credit that's on the line, but she can do whatever she wants with the house. So that's very interesting. She could do a mortgage assignment or a wrap or whatever, and she really doesn't care what happens to the credit. In fact, she probably hopes it's that whoever buys the house doesn't make the payments because it'll screw her ex-husband. So you need to understand whenever you're doing a deal, it's the name that's on the deed. That's the person who actually has to close. That's the person who can sell. It doesn't matter who owes the money. It doesn't matter whose name is on the loan. Only the person whose name is on the deed. Our next list is the bankruptcy list. And I'm going to take a few minutes and talk about bankruptcy. You can check public records for lists of people that have recently filed bankruptcy. That is always in the public records, and sometimes in like the counties that I work in, you can actually go on the county website and get a list of all the people that have filed for bankruptcy. Now, a couple things about bankruptcy. These people have little no equity remaining in their home or might have all their equity in the home. You never know. For some people, because bankruptcy protects the homestead, they may have a lot of equity in their home and be declaring bankruptcy to wipe out their other debts. You know, it's a strange thing the way bankruptcy works. You can own a home that's worth $1 million and you own it free and clear, so you've got a $1 million asset that you own free and clear, and then you owe all these other people millions and millions of dollars. You can declare bankruptcy and it wipes out all the other debt and you still get to keep your house with the $1 million of equity in the house. So it's pretty interesting when people have a lot of equity in their house. Now, that doesn't mean you can pay off all your loans on your house and then declare bankruptcy, because they can actually go back in time and undo that if you've done it in the last year or so. So you want to understand kind of, is this a homestead that's protected by bankruptcy, or is this a non-homestead? If it's a non-homestead and you own it free and clear, then the bankruptcy court can actually tell you you have to sell it to pay off your creditors. So you want to understand when you're talking about somebody who's in bankruptcy, you want to understand, you know, is this a homestead or non-homestead? How much equity is in the house? What's going on here? The other thing you want to understand is that when you buy a house from somebody who's in bankruptcy, you can't actually buy the house while they're in bankruptcy. In general, it's better to talk to somebody who's considering bankruptcy and try to buy the house before they actually declare bankruptcy. And the conversation usually goes like something like this. I talk to a motivated seller, and I negotiate to buy their home, and I ask them if they're thinking of declaring bankruptcy. And I say, look, you know, if you sell your house, you know, do you still need to declare bankruptcy? Would you be able to pay all your other bills if you didn't have the house to worry about? And most of the time, the answer is, you know, hey, if I didn't have this mortgage, you know, I'd be okay. In which case, you might want to have a conversation with them and might want to say, you know, hey, you know, why don't you just sell your house and then you don't have to declare bankruptcy? Now, I will say, I'll make another little comment on this. All the time, I talk to people who are thinking about bankruptcy, and usually, besides talking to me, they're going to go talk to a bankruptcy attorney. And when somebody goes to a bankruptcy attorney and asks a bankruptcy attorney whether or not they need to declare bankruptcy, I guarantee 100% of the time the answer is, oh, yes, of course you need to declare bankruptcy. Everybody needs to declare bankruptcy. And it's very frustrating to me. It's just like, you know, when somebody drives into a brake specialist. You know, if you buy a brand new car and you drive it off the lot, and you drive it across town and you hit the brakes three times at the stop signs across town, and then you pull into the garage of brake specialist and they put it up on the lift, they're going to pull off the wheel and they're going to show you the brake and they're going to show, oh, you know, this brake is worn. Well, that's true. The brake pad got scratched up three times as you tap the brakes across town, right? You know, all brakes are worn. And they're going to say, you know, do you drive on this car? Do you trust these brakes to stop when you need them to? Do you rely on these brakes? Do you drive your family around on these brakes? Are your children relying on these brakes? And, you know, basically they're going to do everything they can to convince you, like they convince everybody that you need new brakes. Bankruptcy attorneys, here's my pet peeve, always tell everybody they need to declare bankruptcy, even when, in my opinion, very often they don't. Because if somebody just has a house that they can't afford, and they can get rid of the house and get rid of the mortgage, and they can afford everything else, then they really don't need to declare bankruptcy. But they may still declare bankruptcy anyway because their bankruptcy attorney told them to. So, long tangent, bottom line is this. When somebody's considering bankruptcy, you may want to tell them, look, let me buy the house before you declare bankruptcy. That way, you know, it doesn't have to be part of the bankruptcy. Or if they already have declared bankruptcy, then you say, look, let's wait until either the house is released from the bankruptcy, or let's file a motion with the bankruptcy trustee so that the bankruptcy trustee can approve the sale of the house to me, which is what you have to do if a house is in bankruptcy when you buy it. Now, one little warning, this is not a common situation, but it is an interesting enough situation that you need to be cognizant of this and need to have this warning given to you. Every once in a while, you will get a smoking deal, and a smoking deal can actually be nullified by the bankruptcy court if a homeowner is judged to have sold the home at a non-market price. What does that mean? Sometimes what will happen is somebody will own a house and it's worth $100,000, and what will they do? They will sell it to their brother for $10, right before they declare bankruptcy. Why? Well, you know, because their idea is, well, I'll get rid of this, my brother will get it, and then in a year from now, after everything is you know, settled down, my brother will sell me back the house for $10. Well, guess what? It doesn't work. Because when you declare bankruptcy, the trustee, the bankruptcy court actually hires somebody to go look at all of the transactions you've done for the last year or more, and if they see anything suspicious, they can actually undo it. And what this means is if you try to buy a house for 50 cents on the dollar from somebody about to declare bankruptcy, he may be willing to sell it to you for $50,000, but you know, 3 months later when he declares bankruptcy, the bankruptcy trustee could look at this thing and they could say, wait, this looks suspicious to me. And they can actually go back to you and they can say, you know, we're going to give you your $50,000 back. You have to give us back the house. You may not even have the house. You may have sold it to somebody else. You may have to unwind the whole deal, which may not even be possible. This doesn't happen very often. If it's a homestead, generally you don't even have to worry about this because homesteads are exempt from the bankruptcy. Somebody can sell their homestead for any price they want. But if it's a non-homestead and it's a smoking deal and it's tied up before a bankruptcy, you might want to understand this and you might want to ask the question, is this going to pass the common sense test? Now, what is fair market price? I would argue fair market price is about 70% of market value. you know, maybe even 65% of market value. That's the cash value of a house in a distressed situation. That's probably going to fly. Less than that, maybe not. Our next mailing list is the modeled and Section 8 list. These are actually two different lists. What is a modeled list? A modeled list is simply a list that predicts people that will be motivated seller. It predicts who the people will be that will be good candidates for your program. Now, for example, I would love to have a list of people whose credit score just dropped from 750 to 500. That's a great list because I know that, you know, something's going on. They've lost their job. They've stopped paying their credit card payments. You know, they're starting to get themselves into trouble. So wouldn't it be wonderful if I could just go to the credit bureaus and say, give me a list of all the people whose credit scores just dropped by 300 points. And unfortunately, that's not available. That's confidential information. You can't just get people's credit score. So such a list does not exist that you have legal access to. So what do you do? Instead of getting that list that doesn't exist, you buy something called a modeled list. And a modeled list is simply, remember the direct mail business is a multi-billion dollar business. They have every kind of information about all of us. They know what credit cards we have. They know where we shop. They know where we bank. They know everything about us. They know what we buy. And they have these lists and databases of all this information. And they can look at the buying patterns and they can predict things about us based on the buying patterns. And I don't even know what the magic patterns are. But for example, if somebody, you know, canceled their Neiman Marcus card and got a Walmart card, you know, or started shopping at Walmart and stopped shopping at Neiman Market, that might be consistent in the pattern with somebody whose income has just gone down and their credit has just gone down. So we can get lists that are modeled for these people whose credit behaviors have changed. And then we can do direct marketing to those people, send our postcards and things to those people, with the idea that a lot of those people are people that are starting to get into financial trouble. And it may be an early indicator for people that will be good candidates, maybe when you can catch them before they're in foreclosure, while it's not too late, good candidates for doing things like mortgage assignments. So that's what a model list is. And if you go to a list broker and you ask them for a model list and have that conversation with them about what you're looking for, they can help find those lists for you or build those lists for you. The next list is the Section 8 landlord list. Now, this is not the best list in the world, but I want to take a few minutes to talk about it because I've done a lot of deals with this list. Generally, every city maintains a list of all Section 8 landlords. Section 8 is a government welfare program or public assistance program for people who can't afford to pay and need public assistance. So what happens is the county will basically pay people's mortgage, pay people's rent, I should say, or supplement their rent. So you apply for Section 8 public assistance, and the city will give you $500 or $1,000 a month, depending on how many kids or dependents you have, towards helping you pay your rent. And what happens if you own rental property, like myself, and you want to make your rental property available to Section 8 tenants, you have to actually register that rental property with the city, and the rental property has to abide by certain rules. You got to have a certain lock on the door and whatever. And so what that means is you can go down to the city and you can look at the Section 8 landlord list, and what do you have? You have a list of all of the property owners that own rental properties that are landlords. And a lot of these landlords actually own multiple properties. So it's a great property owner list. Now, when you get lists of these property owners, one thing I can tell you about people who own a bunch of rental properties, some of these people want more and some of people want less. In other words, it's a great buyer's list. You know, you find a guy that owns, you know, 25 houses in East Austin. If you find a house in East Austin, you call him up and you say, hey, I've got a house. You know, it comes with a mortgage and a mortgage assignment. You may be able to actually get him a house in exchange for a fee. So it's a great buyer's list. And it may also be a great seller's list. You know, some guy has 100 houses and he loses his job, or he inherited 100 houses that he never actually wanted, or he's getting old and wants to retire and he just wants to cash out. And some of these guys are willing to sell their houses and even sell multiple houses at a time. I've done several deals with property owners where I bought, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 houses at a time. One of the best deals I ever did, I got 8 houses for free. In fact, the guy actually gave me 8 houses, and he paid me $35,000 to take them, and then we did an assignment on them simply because he didn't want these houses anymore. So that's how the Section 8 list works. Our next list we're going to talk about is the probate list. And let's take a few minutes and talk about probate. First thing I want to say about probate, what is probate? You know, each county maintains probate files for recently deceased individuals. Every time somebody dies, the county creates a file called a probate file. These are even online. Where I live, the probate files are all actually online. And so I can go and look at all these files of all these people that have died. And generally, you have to sort through the file. When somebody dies, they open a file, and there may be several different records in that file. There may be a will, there may be a death certificate, and generally, one of the documents you're going to find is something called an application to probate. And it's one of the first files, documents that's filed with the county. And it basically says, I'm applying to become the executor of the estate. So it has the name and address of whoever will be settling the estate. And that's a great name and address to have because a lot of times when somebody dies, there is a house to be sold. So you open these files, you go down to the courthouse and you get them, the physical files, or you actually go online, you sort through the electronic copies of these files. And there's kind of two things you can do. You're going to find all sorts of crazy stuff, by the way. It's very interesting when you go through these. You're going to find copies of wills and notes people have left. And, you know, sometimes you'll find something written saying, you know, I hereby leave my house to the guy down the street. And for God's sakes, don't give a damn thing to my no-good brother-in-law, blah, 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 blah. You know, there's a lot of interesting, it's kind of gossipy stuff when you read through people's wills and public records. But you're going to want to, as you're searching through those files, you're going to want to figure out who died. Where they live, that may be on the death certificate. You may have to look it up in the tax records, find out what kind of house they own, and what their situation is. And based on that, you're going to figure out, you know, what kind of deal you may have. Probate Part 2. You're probably going to want to avoid contacting certain people, and you want to contact other people. So, for example, if Dad dies and Mom's still alive, you know, the odds are Mom's going to want to stay in the house, and that's probably not a very good candidate to market to. On the other hand, the best opportunity you could find in the world is where, you know, Dad died and now Mom died and they've left the house to their 3 kids who, guess what, all happen to live out of state. One in Seattle, one in Chicago, and one in New York. Now, what are the odds that 3 kids living in other states are going to come back to Austin, Texas, or whatever city you're in and work to clean up the house and fix it up and put it on the market and sell it? Most of the time when you have that, you know, multiple siblings out of state scenario, inherit a house, whatever, most of the time, you know, they're going to just want to sell the house for cash to somebody who will do it quickly and easily, and that's a very, very good candidate. So you can either dig through the files and figure out which situation each person is and then develop some very customized marketing for each situation and only send marketing to the specific situations that are the high probability deals, or you can take more of the shotgun approach and just send every executor a letter saying we buy houses and hopefully throwing all that spaghetti on the wall, some will stick and you'll get some response back. So that's generally the philosophy for how you do marketing for probate in general. Now, MAPS deals are not that common in general with probate deals. A lot of probate deals actually have a lot of equity in them and may not be ideal probate deals. However, a lot of, you know, probate deals are, you know, low or no equity deals, and those may be the best MAPS deals of all. And the reason is, and I hate to say this, so let me try to say it in a nice way, if somebody's dead, their credit really doesn't matter. In other words, we've got what we call the ultimate no-recourse loan here. If you assign the mortgage from somebody who's dead to a new buyer and the new buyer defaults, you know, what are they going to do? You know, foreclose and hurt the credit of the dead guy? They really can't. So if you propose a mortgage assignment to somebody who's inherited a house that has no equity in it, it's really a no-brainer. Of course I do that. There's absolutely nothing to lose and no way they can object to that. So that's your little MAPS probate tip. Our next list is a non-owner-occupied list. And you can get this list from the tax authorities and or title companies and or realtors. Non-owner-occupied are simply people that own a property. Their name is on the deed. They're the legal owner of the property. But their physical address, they don't actually live at the address of the home. So the address that the taxes go to in the tax records are different than the address of the home itself. So these people have moved out of the home, and these are now rental homes or some other kind of homes. Technically, these people are landlords. You know, they own a home they don't live in, so presumably they're probably renting it to somebody else. Now, one thing we can say about landlords, some are what we call voluntary landlords, and some are non-voluntary landlords. In other words, non-voluntary landlords, you know, they got a job transfer to Seattle, they couldn't sell their house fast, so they rented it out. And you know what? Being a long-distance landlord isn't that much fun, and they probably don't want to be a long-distance landlord forever. That's a non-voluntary landlord. Of course, some of them are sick of being landlords, and then some are voluntary landlords. Voluntary landlords, like the Section 8 guys, they may want more properties, maybe ultimate buyers. When you're marketing to non-owner occupied, you're going to offer to buy the house fast for cash and as is. You know, these guys that are ready to get out, they just want somebody to take over the deal fast and as is. Now, you may or may not want to offer to keep the tenants or kick the tenants out. What do I mean by that? You know, it's so funny. When I buy a property that I'm going to keep as a rental property, if it comes with tenants, that's actually great. You know, that's a better deal. I don't have to now clean up the house and get a new tenant and find somebody to rent it again. It comes with the tenant. And sometimes when I'm negotiating to buy a property subject to, you know, one of the negotiation points that the seller will make will be, you know, hey, I've had this tenant for many years. He's a friend of mine. I really don't want you to kick the tenant out. And I'm thinking about, why would I want to kick the tenant out? So my concession is, okay, if you give me the price I want, we'll keep the tenant. Great, I get the tenant and the price I want. Of course, on the other hand, the situation that I sometimes run into is somebody is selling the house because they actually want to sell the tenant. They're actually more interested in getting rid of the tenant than they are getting rid of the house. Now, perfect case. I've done this deal like three times. You know, mom and dad pass away and they leave the son and daughter the house. And the daughter is a pretty good person, married to a pretty good guy, works pretty hard, you know, God-fearing, whatever. But the son, you know, is a no good, not working drunk. So the son moves into the house under the agreement that he's supposed to pay rent to the daughter. But lo and behold, he's drunk all day, doesn't work, and he never pays rent. So now the husband of the wife who inherited the house, he's got this house, and he's essentially paying a mortgage and taxes and upkeep on a house that his brother-in-law is living in. His brother-in-law is never paying the rent. He kind of gently tells his wife, hey, honey, you know, what are we going to do with your brother? He's not paying the rent. You know, this is costing us a lot of money. Of course, his wife is like, well, he's my brother. You know, what are we going to do? You know, evict him, kick him out. It's really not fair. So if the husband, you know, goes down hard and tries to kick the brother-in-law out of the house, he's going to lose his bedroom privileges with the wife. And that's no good. So what happens is the husband calls me and he basically says, hey, you know, I've got this house. Would you be interested in buying it? And I basically say, yeah, I'll buy it subject to. And then we have a conversation about the tenant. He's like, look, I can't evict him. He's never paid the rent. But what you do with him after you get him, that's your problem. So we get the house with the tenant. And there's kind of a handshake, wink, wink understanding that we're going to get the guy out of there. And the guy who's selling me the house actually wants me to evict the brother. He just can't do it himself. So he's pretty darn happy to get rid of the house, because he's really interested in getting rid of the brother-in-law. And we see that, you know, from time to time. These deals are moderately common, these non-owner-occupied deals. And like I said, when we talked about Section 8, sometimes we find people that are voluntary landlords that have, you know, multiple properties, and we actually do multiple property deals when we find, you know, non-owner-occupied sellers that have a bunch of properties, and maybe, you know, I'll give you a common situation. An investor, you know, came to town and they bought a bunch of properties, but they bought the wrong properties in the wrong part of town. They got them all with zero down loans. The rental thing hasn't been working out so well. They were hoping they were going to go up in value, and they didn't, and now they just want to liquidate the whole batch. We will take the whole batch with the loans, and sometimes, by the way, our exit strategy is as soon as we get all the houses for free with the loans, we immediately go to the tenants, and we offer to sell the house to the tenant. We tell the tenant, hey, if you give us $10,000 down, we'll sell you this house with financing, and that's a really sweet deal. Our next mailing list is the expired listing list. And, you know, this is an old trick with realtors that also works with investors. You know, what do we know about people who have expired listings? Well, first of all, what is an expired listing? Expired listing is simply somebody put a house, they hired a realtor, they put the house on the MLS, and they tried to sell that house. And they had it on the market for, you know, 3, 6, 4, whatever months, and they finally gave up. The listing expired and the house is no longer on the market. Well, what do we know about these people? We know 100% of these people want to sell and they were not successful. So why did it not sell? Well, there's generally 3 or 4 reasons why it didn't sell. There's always at least one reason it didn't sell. The first and most common reason is, you know, is price to loan rather than price to market. The house was $150,000 house, and they owed $150,000. They hired a realtor, and the realtor said it's got to sell for at least $165,000 for you to break even. In other words, by the time you pay closing costs and commissions and seller concessions, you're going to need to sell this thing for $165,000. That's your break even. So they put that $150,000 house on the market for $165,000, and that's you see bazillions of these houses listed. And lo and behold, none of them ever sell because overpriced houses never, ever, ever, ever sell, especially in a, you know, buyer's market. So they just sit there for 6 months and then the listing expires and they're no longer active listings. They're now expired listings. Those are MAPS deals. Those are clean and simple MAPS deals. And you know what? I was actually giving a talk once to a room full of investors and realtors, and I was talking about, you know, mortgage assignment and everything else, and all of a sudden this one woman in the room, she goes, "Oh my God." And I said, "Oh, you know, are you okay? What's wrong?" And she kind of stopped the meeting and she goes, "You know, I have 2 expired listings." I said, "Well, tell me about them." "Oh, they, you know, they were priced at $165,000. They didn't sell it because the house was only worth $150,000. And she says, "And I looked in this subdivision, there's 75 houses in this subdivision that are overpriced. None of them are selling." And I said, "So what you're telling me is you just found 75 MAPS deals." And she goes, "Yeah." "And that's why you're saying, oh my God." And she said, "Yeah. And I'm going to show you how to get those 75 deals, make those your deals in a little while when we talk about letters of intent." So yeah, expired listings are great sources for MAPS deals. Now, other reasons why you might have an expired listings, maybe the house has major problems. Maybe it has major renovations that are needed. These may be renovation deals or equity partnering deals. I have a whole other program where we teach how to do those things. Maybe they're just waiting for the buyer. There's tons of months of inventory, and they just didn't get their house sold in the allotted time. For those, we generally offer combo plans. And basically, we tell those people, "Hey, you know, I have a realtor, I'm an investor, we do a combo plan where my realtor will go ahead and list your house again for you. If she sells it, great, you know, your problem solved, everything's wonderful. If I find a buyer, great, your problem solved, everything's wonderful. If I find a buyer, you don't have to pay the realtor a commission. If she finds a buyer, you don't have to pay me anything." So it's a kind of have your cake and eat it too offer we make. And then, of course, sometimes when we find an expired listing, the owner's just nuts. Even though the house is only worth $150,000, he's convinced it's worth, you know, $200,000 to the right buyer who just doesn't exist on this planet, but maybe they'll come here in a spaceship. Who knows? You know, those are crazy people, and you're never going to do any business with them. So you're going to basically approach these people with direct mail, you know, call, send letter of intent. We like to kind of escalate our interface. We contact them passively through direct mail. We physically call them on the phone if they don't respond to us, and then we might actually send them a letter of intent, which we'll go through in a few minutes.